All opinions expressed by myself and podcast guests are solely our own opinions. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Hello, this is Terry Howe, and today I'm here with Michael Frasis, a founder and portfolio manager of Frasis Capital Partners based in Australia. The firm runs a global equity long-short strategy primarily focused on the listed companies with innovative growth stories in technology and life science sectors that are expected to benefit from long-term structural shifts across economies, industries, as well as the underlying companies. Today, we will discuss four broad areas, including Michael and his team's background, his investment philosophy, approach, and his insights across the global markets. Finally, we will walk through his experience in the space, key learnings, and plans that he has in the future. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. Let's jump right in. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure, Terry, and thanks so much for having me on. So my background is I grew up in Sydney, Australia. I did my undergraduate in Oxford in the United Kingdom in chemistry. I did a master's there focusing my research on enzyme-catalyzed fuel cells. I then did a Master of Finance at London School of Economics and worked in private equity in London for about 5 years before coming back home to Australia and setting up this fund, this business, about 4 years ago.
How has your background in private equity in London translated into your current strategy? And if you can give us a quick overview of what you were covering within that PE firm. And then, of course, how did that transition into your interest in running a long-short strategy?
Private equity, the approach was fairly traditional. It was in sectors like real estate, pubs, media, assets like that, cash flow positive, very conventional approach to valuation. A lot of it was distressed. So it was a firm that bought a lot of assets around 2009, 2010. It was really kind of conventional approach of you do a typical buyout model, you'd buy something and then use the cash flows to pay down debt and generate a return. And that is very different to the kind of companies we're investing in now. But I think having a good grounding in the fundamentals really helps, because often the best returns are in growth companies, which are investing extremely heavily, often above the EBITDA line. They're investing in sales and marketing, getting astronomical returns on that spend. But because it's happening above the EBITDA line, it's very hard to measure them using traditional profit and cash flow metrics. So having a background in that approach, the traditional approach, really made it possible to expand on that. I think if you can try and do something different, often it's best to have a grounding in what you're trying to do something different from. In many ways, I had a very traditional introduction to investing in private equity. I was reading the same value books that everybody else did. But the reality is the best investment returns for the past decade, even 2 decades, as you go back further than that, didn't actually come from companies that looked very good on traditional metrics. It was often companies that had other characteristics, which we've been able to identify and codify and build into our process. And so in terms of what I learned a lot. I think it's very bad to stand outside of paradigms and throw stones at them. I think you need to come from within. I think you need to understand why people do things a certain way to really get a strong enough grounding to understand how you can potentially do them differently and perform quite well. So it's very helpful. And obviously, the leap from chemistry has been helpful as well. Everybody in chemistry is very pedantic. You know, you have to pay a lot of attention to detail. Details matter. Conventions matter. It's very rigorous. And it's a very difficult subject as well. So having that background really kind of gives you the confidence to then invest in areas like in the life sciences, where there's phenomenal opportunities, but very few people have the technical grounding to read a complicated scientific paper and then make sense of it, really assess it critically and figure out what's important, what's not. So those two aspects of the background were pretty important, I think.
Yeah, I can definitely see the parallels, and we can kind of dig into that a little later. Maybe just quickly on your team, how did you guys come together and what was the driving force for you guys to come together and set up the firm?
Sure, there's a few of us. We've done a partnership with a firm in Melbourne called Tanara. It's run by a guy called John Wiley. He sold his investment bank to Lazard many years ago and has now set up a multi-billion dollar asset management firm based out of Melbourne. And we originally met through Oxford University, so we're both looking for ways to work and help the innovation that's going on there. So when I was at Oxford, there was very little commercialization of science. There's a handful of companies a year being developed. And even those were done quite quietly. Shortly after I left, a firm was put together. They basically did a deal with the university where they got a significant equity percentage of every spin out from science, engineering, and medicine. In doing so, they then raised about £600 million from some of the top investors in the world, like Temasek and Google Ventures, and then hired a bunch of very young people who were basically, you know, my peers at the time, people with a few years of experience, and made them principal investors. So the whole thing was like a very innovative approach to raising money, innovative approach fostering commercialization, and then very innovative approach to hiring. And then they got to a point where they were setting up 25 to 30 companies a year and really creating an ecosystem. So John Wiley was a Rhodes Scholar and was heavily involved in that program there and heavily invested in some of these really exciting hard tech startups. They're not really websites. They're people creating drones that swim like whales. They're silent, so can't be picked up using conventional anti-submarine monitoring, or fly like mosquitoes, or generating new materials, like really tough scientific problems and commercializing them. So we met in that context a few years ago and stayed in touch, and have now obviously done a deal. We're partnering up to try and build this business in the listed space based out of Australia. The other person on the investment team is Joel Tomeno, who actually just recently joined from another fund. So we've been industry contacts for a very long time. We're rounded out by Anna, who's actually a family member. So we've known each other our entire lives. She was originally working at BT, which is one of the major asset management groups in Australia, decided to join and do this, and here we are.
Why don't we dive into the market and the opportunity? Well, let's go top down. Could you tell us what you see as the key trends they see across the global markets right now? How you think about these as you look at the different markets and companies, and what those investors with interest in global markets should be thinking about right now?
Sure. So this has probably been one of the best times to be an active manager, because triggered by the coronavirus, there's a huge change in global spending and where that money actually went. So if you think about it, from March onwards, effectively significant parts of the world and probably aggregate spending is down across the planet, whether it's business or consumer. But there's been a huge shift in that spending. Travel and eating out, dining out, which are actually huge things that people spend a lot of money on, basically went down to zero. And then small pockets of the global economy absolutely skyrocketed. So things like e-commerce around the world, digital health. So you had this strange period where everything was kind of depressed, which knocked down indices. But there were some parts of the economy that were very visibly accelerating and having their best years on record, whether it was at Shopify in Canada or Mercado Libre in South America or C in Southeast Asia. These companies really had the best times they've ever had. And so if being able to pivot, being active, and being able to just effectively rule out anything that was struggling and invest entirely in those sectors where people were visibly accelerating, that proved a very effective strategy in April and onwards till today. Now you've got a very complicated, very interesting question, which is slightly different. Many of these trends, just accelerations. For example, things like digital health. Like, it always made so much sense to do consultations online wherever possible. But for whatever reason, people just didn't do it. There's a good chance that shift is now permanent. On the other hand, there's a very good chance that the reduction in spending on things like travel actually bounces back with a vengeance. You could really see a scenario where certainly 2022 is the best year in the travel industry on record. And things are not priced like that today. So when you think about where we are now, we're potentially at a transition point where the play for the last 6 months has been to only invest in companies that are visibly accelerating. And we actually made that call in April and wrote about it and ran the rule over our entire portfolio and crossed out anything that wasn't doing well in the environment. It was really a time to be backing winners. It wasn't a time to be bottom feeding and buying the most smashed up industries. You really wanted to buy the best companies and fastest growing companies that were accelerating at 20, 30% discounts, and then obviously ride them onto significant new highs. But the reason now it's so interesting is because there's a good chance that at least some of those trends start reversing. So I think that's the golden question now. How many of these companies had years of demand pulled forward and that will now suffer in the next few years? And then which companies have a huge amount of pent-up demand that will return in force over the next couple of years? When we look back on today in 12 months' time, there's a good chance that they're the best returning assets. So we're trying to balance and think about the way those two aspects of the global economy at the moment. It's also very important to note that we're in a very supportive environment as well. There's no talk of tightening. There's no talk of fiscal austerity. Rates are still very low. Should things deteriorate, there is no doubt that policymakers will do what they did in the past, which is support the markets. So there is generally a pretty positive backdrop. If you can find a good growth story, an exciting company that's growing 100% plus year on year, there's a good chance that asset will be bid up. So it's a very positive backdrop in that regard still.
Yeah, you touched on digital health as a segment, and you also mentioned Shopify, right? I believe, which is kind of online retail. Are there other market segments or industries that you find particularly interesting, or give us a little more color on some of the things you mentioned?
There's some really interesting things going on in digital payments. Companies like Afterpay in Australia, which maybe are not very well known overseas, growing 100% year on year for several years in a row now. You'd think that payments is something that would be very easy to do in the modern world, but it turns out there's still so many efficiencies going on and so many new business models that can be created. Digital health, I'd put that in the bucket of things that is a permanent shift. I think companies like Teladoc and Livongo, which are now merging, the future is very bright for them. It just makes so much sense for people who are ill not to have to go and wait in the waiting room and infect other people. Similarly, it makes so much sense for people to be tracked. There's so much insurance value that can be created if people are taking their insulin at the right time or people are exercising, and so many novel business models will be able to capture that. So they're pretty exciting as well. Within life sciences, there's a few foundational technologies that are just coming of age as well. I'll give an example of Twist Bioscience. This is the company, they're the best people at synthesizing DNA. That's useful because firstly, it's used in synthetic biology, which is a growing industry, but it's also used to sequence things and just, for example, to sequence people's genomes. Now that's interesting, but of course, there's only so many people in the world. Where it gets really interesting is it's very helpful for sequencing diseases. For example, you could sequence viruses as they progress through a population, which is very relevant today. You could also sequence cancers as they evolve within each person. And there's a number of new companies that are developing blood tests for cancer. So you've got Guardant in the United States, and Grail is also about to list, which is backed by Bill Gates. These people have always known that tumors shed DNA. It's just been an extremely difficult technical challenge. If you imagine doing a draw of blood and then trying to find that one bit of stray DNA that has a cancerous mutation, it's almost impossible. It took people 10 years to sequence one genome. Imagine sequencing all the stray DNA in a sample. Very difficult problem, but now sequencing is just getting to the point where that's possible. And so these businesses have this kind of staged approach where they can first sequence a particular cancer to see what the correct treatment is, the treatment selection. It's kind of an easier problem because you know what the cancer is, you know what to look for. The second thing they're going to do is test for recurrence monitoring. So the idea is that if you could pick up on this stray or circulating tumor DNA, you could pick up in the blood long before symptoms became apparent, effectively save lives that way. And that's the area that's being tested at the moment when going through extensive trials for specific cancers. But very little doubt that that will happen eventually. Third step is obviously universal screening of people. And actually, that whole diagnostic space is really interesting. When you think about how much data we are able to get, biological data from people, and how little we actually do, it just shows like the scale of the opportunity. These are enormous markets, and there's companies that will just grow into those markets for a very long time. I guess, of course, the other one is impossible to ignore is software. There's still software companies that are 4 or 5 years old that are now generating hundreds of millions of dollars of extremely high margin revenue, and they're investing all of that revenue into getting the next leg up of growth. And so I think that trend towards spending more on software is just going to continue. So that's another area that I think is quite interesting. I think software is the place where many things are fairly fully valued at the moment. I'd say you're much more likely to find very cheap, high growth, long-term stories in other parts of the market.
If we look at the bull market right now, US stocks continue to be at all-time highs right now, although, you know, there has been a bit of interim volatility, at least in September this month. What are your views on the outlook for the equity markets, and do you see as the medium to long-term opportunities?
There's no doubt indices have run pretty far ahead of themselves, I'd say. At the end of the day, the long-term returns probably going to approximately equal the long-term growth rate. At the moment, the NASDAQ has absolutely ripped. We've definitely been beneficiaries of that, seeing as we're very focused on technology and life sciences. But ultimately, these are multi-decade stories. Like, this is technology we're talking about. There's new companies that will be formed and will continue to grow, I suspect, throughout our lifetimes. Yeah, we're looking at charts, just using those macro indicators, for example, call buying, which often coincides with temporary market tops. And it wouldn't be great to go back 5 years and invest in the top of the NASDAQ for the year then. Returns would have been still phenomenal. It's much more important that you invested in these companies 3 or 4 years ago and held them through the cycles. That's where the real money was there to be made. So that's kind of our current market view, which isn't really price dependent. If you think technology is going to grow for 20 or 30 years, then really you should be investing as much as you can now. And I'd say that most of the conversations we have, these kind of fast growing technology companies that are really changing the world, they're generally small parts of people's portfolios. It really should be the reverse. You'd have a better feel for how people are investing across Asia and around the world. But in Australia, there's certainly people who have come around to the idea of investing in the large tech companies, like your Amazons, Googles, Facebooks. But people have very little allocations to the leading global small and mid-cap companies. And these are the companies that are growing 50 to 100% plus year after year after year and generating, in many cases, the best returns available in the markets. And that's where we're focusing our attention.
This year, apart from the pandemic, we've also seen and we'll expect to see more geopolitical tensions of factors being a function of driving what's happening in the equity market. Has any of this influenced what you or your team focus on today and how you guys are managing your portfolio?
Look, ultimately, I think you need to look through these things. There'll be people that will want to trade these. There's probably clever ways to do that. Often the moves that happen are reversed. They generally net out. So think about what happened with Donald Trump. He got elected. There was a very sharp sell-off. I'm sure a lot of people sold futures and potentially sold their stocks in places where markets are open. But that was shortly reversed. So I think moments in time that are very well flagged, like an election, they're so risky in the market if you trade. Because often the first move is not the correct move. So you could see a case where Democrats were elected and markets sold off. And that was like a short-term bottom. My view is on those kinds of things, you're better off not reacting. Our job is we have a very high growth rate across our portfolio. So our organic growth rate on a weighted basis is probably over 70%. And so what we really want to do is just make sure we capture that 70% growth rate. It's like the structural basis for our return. So we really don't want to be shaken out of these positions over something that's almost certainly short-term and may well be reversed. And I think on that, on the election, the real danger is past. Joe Biden is not a radical. And I think markets are very comfortable with Donald Trump's approach, for better or worse. And so it's not like there's crazy left winger or crazy right winger that could potentially win and throw things into a spin. So for better or worse, we're going to be very steady through the election and probably maintain our positions and maintain our investments. And I think that might actually prove to be the right course.
We'd love to dive into your coverage and also your approach a little bit as well. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your investment philosophy, and why do you think your investment philosophy and approach has been so effective across the markets?
Sure. So investment philosophy is actually pretty structured at the moment. So we invest in companies with three characteristics. Firstly, intense customer love for their products. Secondly, explosive growth. And thirdly, we look for the actual market leaders and category creators. And the reason that's so interesting is because it really offers a lens through which you can really identify and then understand the best returning opportunities of the past decade or so. So I'll give you some examples. If you think about Tesla, Netflix, in Australia, Afterpay, early days Amazon, these were companies with intense customer bases that were extremely controversial in the investment community. These are some of the most heavily shorted stocks. One of our stocks, which is up about 5 or 6 times since we bought it a year and a half ago, Carvana, when we purchased it, short interest was 70% of the free float. Similarly, Tesla, you don't need me to tell you, has been extremely heavily shorted very vocally the entire time, as it's been one of the top performing stocks. It's up 20 times or something since we first bought it. And so many of these controversial stocks have not just resolved themselves. They haven't just been good performers, they've been some of the best performers globally. You could even use something like Bitcoin in that framework, where you see that intense user base, that ability to enrapture the entire planet. But there was that moment where it seemed like every single person in every single country was talking about it, an explosive growth in user base, and really see that as a lens of how you could potentially identify these things and make sense of them. Now, the reason we look at explosive growth and customer love is they're really interconnected. If something's really interesting and good and people love it, then you should be able to see that in the numbers. And not just their revenue growth, their spend per user, the web traffic, Google search data, reviews, all that stuff should be pointing in the same direction. There should be people queuing outside their shops, for example, in Apple's case, or the ability to generate hundreds of thousands of pre-orders in Tesla's case. That's kind of what we mean by customer love, but it has to come with explosive growth. Similarly, the fact that we're looking for explosive growth makes it much easier to identify these companies because we know what to look for. A lot of people miss these stories because they don't quite understand them. Well, I think you should start with what's going on. Start with the reality. It's like, okay, something's exciting is happening here if a car company is increasing its production by 50 times. You don't need to get it right to realize that something's going on. Or similarly in Australia, Afterpay, which is a company I mentioned a couple of times, which may not be familiar to the listeners now, from 100,000 customers to 500,000 to 1 million, 2 million, 10 million, like heavily debated company, there's no doubt there's something interesting going on. So when we think about idea generation, that's how we try and find our companies. What are people spending time on? Pinduoduo is an example in China. You know, people are spending hours and hours and hours on that site long before the revenue growth came. Or rather, the percentage growth was always very high. But the fact that people are spending hours and hours a day on it really gave an indication of where the revenue was growing. Like there was something big there. So those two things are very important. Intense customer love and explosive growth. The third one, I think, keeps you out of trouble. So that market leadership point. So you want the number one in the sector. You don't want the number two or the number three, because there's often when there's like an area of innovation, there'll be a number of companies growing extremely fast into the greenfield opportunity. But often when you think about that industry as it matures, generally things will coalesce around the leader. E-commerce is an example where the market leader generally has a bigger range, lower prices and faster delivery. So very hard to compete, even though there'll be sectors and moments and companies that seem like they'll be able to pip the number one. Generally, it's the number one that wins. Like these are companies that you can have a lot of money invested across a number of different funds and find that on net, you are short companies like Tesla and you had very little exposure to companies like Afterpay. We hold about 30 of these companies. Now, our job is to create a portfolio that consists of just opportunities like this. It takes a lot of work and you've got to think really hard. And I think it helps if you have like the right framework to understand how these companies are creating so much value and why they look so bad to most professional investors. I read the same books as everybody else, value investing. I came from the same philosophy, you know, read all of Buffett's letters, all that kind of stuff. The interesting thing about these companies is they have a rare problem in finance. Their problem is that they have so much demand they're struggling to meet. They're having to invest heavily in factories, or every dollar they spend on advertising comes back tenfold. So they spend all the revenue on sales and marketing. And so then what you see is these companies have huge expense lines while they're growing at 50 to 100% or even more every year. And so somebody who looks at it from a cash flow perspective will just see those losses. They won't see the fact that the unit economics were excellent, but they spent all of that unit economic profit on getting the next set of customers. And that's how you see companies go from $50 million, $100 million, $200 million, $400 million of revenue. They never look like value stocks. They never show those characteristics that people are taught and kind of feel like they need to be looking for. It's not like some of these companies are good, some of these are bad. Companies with those characteristics, that ability to generate immense return on marketing spend, intense growth, and have intense demand for their products, they're often the best returners. And a lot of people seem to just systematically miss those kinds of companies.
Could you give us some insights into how your top-down and bottom-up approaches are combined to select innovative companies within secular themes? Why do you think this approach is effective? And what do you think are the most important factors that give you the edge in identifying opportunities and expressing them in the most effective manner?
Yeah, I mean, I think we always want to be invested in winners and companies that are winning. Part of that comes from trying to really simplify things. We don't want to have opinions over what will work or why customers will pick one thing or another. We want to actually see what people are picking. I think opinions can be very dangerous in this game. The modern world allows you to do this. You can track in real time things like web stats. This is all public available information. Often the best guide to what people are going to be liking and using next year is, did they like and use it this year? Twice as many people are using a product today as they were last year. That's intrinsically very interesting. But it's also a very good guide that through word of mouth and other mechanisms, twice as many people might be using it next year as well. So we're really focused on those micro data, like what's happening at that user level. There's that moment where a customer picks one product over another, whether it's a payment option at the checkout, the online checkout, or if they type in a search engine over another search engine, or they pick one set of shoes or another set of shoes. That decision point is where all the value is created and lost in the business world. So we really want to go deep and understand which companies are winning at that decision point. That's the starting point. As I said, we don't want to have our own opinions. We want to use data to kind of verify and support those opinions. But secondly, once we do see something that's winning, then we really want to understand it properly and get down into that specific moment. And I think in the investing world in particular, when people talk about things like, I don't know, quality, they'll often talk about things that may not even matter long-term, you know, like things like business quality, cash flow, sustainability of earnings, all that kind of stuff. Far more important and far more productive, we believe, to focus on the consumer, how they're picking the products that they do and why one company is winning at a particular moment, at a particular key decision point. I think that focus is actually quite different to where most people focus. And the reason it's so important is that's what drives the fundamentals. To some extent, we are all in the future prediction game, much as we'd like not to be sometimes because it's so difficult, but that's what drives value. So we have three car stocks, Carvana, Tesla, and one we haven't disclosed. All three of them grew through a steep auto recession. I think at one point, car sales were down 50% across most of the planet year on year. So we were able to identify three companies that were able to grow during that crazy period. I think that the reason we got those isn't because we were predicting that they would do well in this environment. We obviously expect everything to do poorly in that kind of environment. But because we had big companies that customers really liked and loved, they were able to maintain their spending and actually grow and do well in very tough conditions. And that obviously affects all the kind of fundamentals, which is like the end result for us. Most people start those kind of economic things. So I think it's quite an interesting approach and a different approach to trying to find the best opportunities in listed markets.
Maybe you can kind of dive in a little bit more and tell us a little bit more about how do you conduct the analysis on those? What are the key metrics or differentiated metrics that you guys would look at that others might not?
Sure. I mean, I think it's more a matter of a focus rather than what's available. You can obviously look at things like web traffic, Google Trends, pre-orders for products, ratings, which companies moving up and down in website rankings, things like that. You can also see which companies are able to generate buzz, which companies people are queuing at. So, like, these are almost intangible things. I'll give you an example, though. Think about what happened in smartphones, like a detailed industry example, hopefully gives some insight into the way we think. Think about what happened in smartphones maybe 10 years ago when Apple launched the iPhone. You had fierce existing competitors. You had Nokia, BlackBerry, you had Microsoft made a huge play, Then you had all these up-and-coming Asian firms which had a red-hot crack, you know, firms like Samsung, Huawei. There was only really one company that people were queuing outside before setting up tents and doing crazy things like that, and that was Apple. And what ended up happening is that there were many years where Apple was able to turn that customer love that we talk about into a few hundred, extra $100 of price per iPhone, and that ended up being the entire profit margin of the entire industry. So Samsung, Huawei, all these other players were able to generate significant market share, or massive and more market share than Apple. Because Apple was able to charge a premium, all the others had to compete on price and features. So Apple was able to generate the entire, basically the free cash flow margin of the industry. There's a good chance something like that happens in cars, where Tesla's acknowledged as a market leader and people are willing to pay significantly more for those cars. And then you see a large number of manufacturers constantly competing on price and features. Like if you're on a mid-sized family SUV, you have so many options. The market is so efficient. And often the way people win market share is by offering dealership incentives and things like that. And so you can really see how there's lots of companies with brands. Ford has a brand. There's plenty of companies in the smartphone industry with brands, but there's very few companies that have that customer love. So we're really focused on finding and identifying those companies. And once we think we have it, I think it's generally pretty obvious just using those kind of examples of how you'd identify and then see those. And then, of course, we'll also use really simple top-line measures. We want to see users growing. We want to see revenue per user growing. We want to see revenues growing. That is what makes it interesting. That is what ultimately generates value in these companies. They'll be, if companies twice the size, year after year after year, and it's 2, 4, 8, 16 times larger 4 years later, that often the stock will follow that. In many ways, it's often when that growth slows down that things derate. And so we're very focused on those kinds of metrics. Every portfolio in the company will score very well on those metrics as well. So we try and measure them on a portfolio basis as well.
That leads in well into our next question. What is critical for you when constructing your portfolio and managing risk, considering your approach?
I guess that's a bit of an evolution for us. If you spoke to me a couple of years ago, I probably would have had been much more concentrated. Now we have 30, 35 positions. Back then, we probably had 15 and really 6 or 7 large ones. It was almost like a bit of a fashion back then. The last 2 years, there was some pretty big sell-offs. Beginning of 2018, then it was December 2018, which was raising rates and trade war. And then obviously there's coronavirus, which was bigger than the other two. And one thing we've learned is that, you know, if you have those concentrated positions, it creates a lot of pressure. I mean, we feel a lot of responsibility. We've got people's money. In many cases, we've got people's retirement assets invested with us. And also, we're pretty much the only exposure these people have to these kinds of companies because they're ignored by the vast majority of managers. So yeah, I feel like we have a real responsibility to capture that uplift, capture that growth. And what I'd hate to happen is we make a mistake on a very large position and then not deliver the return we need for our investors. I'd much prefer to have 25 to 35 stocks, and we're kind of on the upper end of that now, and then just have a much better chance of capturing that growth, capturing that technology uplift. So that's kind of how we think about that. The way that relates to risk is there's no single position that can really ruin us. In the equity markets, the best risk return comes from those 4 to 5% positions, because we'll get them wrong, as like everybody will make mistakes. But if you have a 4% position that drops 25%, you've only lost 100 basis points. It's not huge on a portfolio basis. But if you get that right, 3, 4, 5 years down the track, that 4% could be 25% or more. And we've identified a significant number of companies that have tripled or more. So it's not idle talk either. So I really think that's the best risk reward in the market, is making those small equity positions that are growing extremely fast, that have the potential to generate multiple returns on investment.
Thank you. You know, given the views you've expressed, what do you think is the best way to participate in global equities? Key things to consider, and where have you found yourself to be most successful in navigating these markets?
Look, I think if you're trying to participate in equity markets, everybody has risk. It's so important to stay on top of the companies that are doing well. So many examples of this. For example, look at the performance of companies like Shopify versus the entire retail sector in the United States. It's been flat to negative for many, many years. It's so important to stay on top of these kinds of companies. So if we've identified 35 companies that are growing at exceptionally high rates in a stagnant global economy, those dollars are coming from somebody else. In Australia, the major banks were exceptional performers, very high dividend payers, seem to form the core of most people's retirement portfolios. Each of them has lost tens of billions of dollars over the last year or so. They're heavily regulated industries. This was happening before coronavirus. Now with coronavirus, with all the government support, even more so. It's going to be very hard for people to generate retirement returns that they need out of companies like that. And then you've got some of these most astounding performances from local Australian fintech companies, like Afterpay, which is up 15 to 20 times, depending when you bought it. Companies like Xero, which are up fourfold. It's so important to stay on top of the shifts that are happening. And so when you get these big sell-offs, we're very much long bias. So we will drop with the market, but at least our companies are able to grow through crises. At least they mostly have net cash on their balance sheet. At least if the stocks are volatile every quarter, the companies are 10, 15, 20% bigger than they were the previous quarter. It's so important if you're taking that equity risk to really get paid for it and really have those higher returns on the table. So far year to date, to the end of August, we're up 54% net. So even though we're kind of effectively, people consider us as a very exposed strategy because we effectively take long-term positions in these companies that look very risky from traditional metrics, even though to us, we're extremely comfortable with companies that have these immensely supportive customer bases. It's such an important part of people's portfolios because times like this, you can really generate high returns and make up for losses elsewhere. So my view is if you're taking equity risk, you should be doing it in a way that really allows you to get paid. And if you don't want to take that kind of risk, you're probably better off in other parts of the market.
This is a good time to also touch a little bit more on the risk management part. The volatility, as you mentioned, in 2018, towards the end, there was a lot of volatility, and then also this year as well. When focusing and identifying and making longer-term bets for yourself, could you elaborate and tell us what are the core risks that you would look at and what are the best ways to manage them?
The kind of companies we're in, they've kind of different problems to most other companies. I mean, the companies are fundamentally doing extraordinarily well. It doesn't matter what the stocks are doing. They're growing fast. They're generating huge amounts of gross profit. They may choose to then spend that, but there's very little doubt that they're winning in their respective areas. The risk is more a market risk thing where, particularly in parts of software, the very good companies are bid up excessively. Often that ends up being somewhat rational. Like if you could go back 5 years and pay up Shopify at 25 times sales, you've done exceptionally well. You've had one of the best performing stocks because they have to compound so much over 5 years. But in the short term, that's what people really worry about, particularly when it comes to fund investing, because there's that moment where you make an investment in a fund. The fund then goes up 25% and then draws down. You probably don't mind so much. You'll then just ride it out and then get the next big uplift. But if you invest and then it draws down immediately after that, I think that's what people worry about because all of a sudden they've got a real problem and a real issue they have to think through. The answer to those kinds of things is you've got to pick strategies that you're comfortable have structural reasons to outperform, structural reasons to grow. As I mentioned before, our companies are 4 to 5% larger every month. So when we're down, because we will have bad months along with everybody else, you know that not only the stock's cheaper, but also larger. So on a per revenue or whatever metric you want to use basis, they're much cheaper than the drawdown itself, which really gets into the situation where you wind up your returns, where the fund goes sideways or a little bit down for a few months and then really rips hard at the end. I think you need to be in strategies that have that dynamic. One of the risks in long short funds is some of them won't have that. If you're 100 long, 100 short, and I just don't have any particular fund in mind, but you can get the longs right and the shorts right for a number of years in a row. But if you get the longs wrong and the shorts wrong at the same time, you can take a fairly big drawdown. But because you're 100 long, 100 short, there's no structural reason for you to bounce back. There's no structural reason for you just betting on fund getting it right in the future, which may or may not happen. I think the best way to manage some of these risks is to make sure you've got these huge tailwinds in the portfolio that are forming the basis of the returns. And that's what we're trying to do. There's no doubt we're an equity strategy. And so we will bear those market volatility risks with everybody else. But as this year shows, sometimes that offers up enough opportunity that it was worthwhile. It's ended up being a very good year for us. Even though if you spoke to us in March, we wouldn't have said the same thing.
I think for a lot of people in March, they weren't too exactly sure what was going to play out either. And also, you touched on a very good point, you know, as a fund allocator, timing in terms of when to enter into a manager is intensely important. But at the same time, like you say, it's very difficult to manage. Thank you for your insights on that. Maybe you can give us a little bit more about your insights and interpretation of the current environment, as well as what you expect in the upcoming as we exit the current situation. I know you touched on it a little bit, and from a medium long-term perspective, what are you seeing?
In April, we ran the ruler of the portfolio and said we're only going to be in things that are accelerating. Now we're running the ruler of the portfolio and going, okay, which one of these companies are having the best environment they'll ever have, and which of them will reverse? Or rather, which ones are sustainable and which ones are not. Some of the statistics that we were looking at were astronomical. So Mercado Libre and Sea, I'll just use these two examples. They're e-commerce market leaders in Southeast Asia and South America. Mercado Libre in South America has more of a payment spend. And Sea obviously has a thriving gaming business where they effectively, they adapt Tencent games and also adapted shooter games with lower graphics components. So they're very successful in the emerging world. Many of the countries in those regions have e-commerce penetration of under 5%, online payments penetration of lower than that, their cash economies. That is such a low base. If you think about the US at 25 to 35, depending on how you measure and whether you include coronavirus effects, and China even higher than that, there is so much further for those economies to go as they develop, as online penetration increases, and then as e-commerce becomes like a bigger share of wallet. In many cases, those companies have tripled or more over the last 6 months. But the reality is these are 10x, 20x, 30x potential opportunities. And I'm talking about over the next decade or so, not over the next year or two. But there's such a good structural reason for these companies to continue to grow and continue to outperform. And so if we did this work, we expected to say, okay, now's the time to rotate. But the reality is we've actually decided to stick with and increase some of these positions. But I do think it's important to keep that rotation in mind because that spending will come back. So an example of a company that we've invested in to help capture that is Disney. So it's obviously got that customer love. It's got that amazing Marvel, Star Wars universes. That customer love for those universes translates directly into blockbuster hit after blockbuster hit. It's very tangible. It translates into revenues. They've also got Disney Plus, which grew to a third of the number of Netflix subscribers in less than a year. So you've got that explosive growth there. But half their profit basically came from theme parks, maybe less than half, more like 40, 45%. It's almost like the market wrote that down to zero and then just valued the increase in Disney Plus. But we truly expect travel to come roaring back. Everyone we speak to is just dying to do a trip, to visit people, travel. It's going to be a really interesting time when that returns because, like we said earlier, we think that'll be the best year in travel ever. So we're looking at ways like Disney that have extremely high quality market leadership, explosive growth, customer love, but will also benefit from a rebound and normalization. I think that's another thing we're actively thinking about and actively positioning for. But broadly, I think you highlight a couple of risks coming up, for example, the US election. And whenever markets have these huge upwards moves, you know, there's a good chance the next move is down. Markets are two steps forward, one step back at the best of times. That is where we are at the moment. We've taken many steps forward. But the reality is that the true winners were the people that hold on to these companies long term. And I don't mean like, you know, 20, 30 years. I mean like 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Get that compound, get that 50, 60, 70% growth. But don't get it 1 year, or just certainly don't get it over 3 months. Get over 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. That's where you get these incredible increases in wealth. And that to me is what really makes equity risk and equity investing worthwhile, is the ability to capture those. We've used this framework to identify a number of them. And I think once you start thinking like this, the next time you see a stock go up tenfold with an immense customer base, everyone's raving about it, but all the professional investors hate it. They'll be shorting it. They'll be writing blog posts, quoting Warren Buffett. Think about customer love, explosive growth, market leadership, because there's a good chance it fits those. And I think it's a really helpful way of looking at the world.
I guess leading from that a little bit, what do you think is the most important factors that would enable managers such as yourself to consistently generate absolute returns from the markets, especially given constantly changing regimes and also in underlying companies as well?
The benefit we have versus the market, the reason we're able to outperform, is most companies are roughly the same size every year. Most companies are leveraged, the capital intensive. Often those kind of traditional like industrial stocks, they're very exposed at times like this when revenues drop a little bit. Often that can wipe out their entire profit. In some cases, threaten their entire existence. So I think of an index that's full with a large number of companies like that. Then I think there's a small sector of market indices where the company is growing extremely fast, where dollars are flowing to. Good software business. Think of what Google, Microsoft, Amazon, all those companies have done to consumers and businesses. They bill us every month. It just comes out of our accounts automatically and into theirs. They're such powerful business models. It makes so much sense for companies like that to continue to outperform. The regime shifts will come. Multiples have traded up from exceptionally low base in 2016 to probably exceptionally high base now. So you will potentially get that 20, 30, 40% multiple correction. But in many cases, a lot of the companies we're investing will be 20, 30, 40% larger in 6 to 12 months, which isn't very long. So my view on that is you really just want to be invested in these companies through the long term and then kind of ride out those gyrations, ride out those regime shifts, and just make sure you're really focusing on quality. And by that, we mean companies that people really want to use, that have a really compelling value proposition, not to investors, but to customers. I really think that's the best framework to approach equity investing.
I think we were talking a bit earlier as well about how, you know, if you have a conviction on the underlying manager to manage through the different regimes, that should always also be something to focus on as well if you've made a commitment to it. I guess it's the same for you guys as you're looking at the underlying companies. Michael, to wrap, you've been in the markets for a while now. Could you tell us a little bit about your key learnings, any setbacks you've experienced, and how has all of this made you a better investor?
Yeah, I mean, like anyone, we have had a number of setbacks. One of the things we've done is we realized in many cases our worst year was 2019. 2018 was a bad year for us, but it would have been fine. The issue was that then we were doing a lot of shorting. And so we ended up doing 24% in 2019, but we probably needed to do a lot more. Like our long only did 70 in account we're running, and our long short did 24. So in that year, we lost more on the short side than you could probably ever really make on a good year for the short side. And that's broadly why we do so little of that now. It was a real lesson in what not to do, because if we effectively got caught short in late 2018 and then had to reverse those positions at great expense and great risk, because obviously if you close out some shorts after you've lost money on them, you risk a market reversal and then losing on both sides, which can be fatal. Fortunately, we got that right and we survived and generated a positive return, basically because the stock selection was correct. But then what happened in coronavirus, you could argue that, well, you basically closed a lot of your shorts right before the biggest sell-off. The UK has market history going back centuries, the sharpest sell-off by those records since Isaac Newton lost all his money in the South Sea bubble. Good thing that was, okay, the worst possible time to take off your shorts, but it ended up being the best. Because I firmly believe there were so many moments where you could get tripped up, trading around, adjusting exposures. When things were moving, there were so many limit down and limit up days, so much volatility. But in reality, all that volatility basically netted, washed out. Markets are roughly back to where they were, and tech stocks are much higher. So the experience we had in 2018 and 2019 prepared us for that in the best possible way. So we could see people moving to cash. We could see people reducing their exposures. But it's kind of too late when markets are down 20 or 30%. It's good business sense. If you have a business and times get tough, you tighten your belt, you reduce risk. That's good business sense. But our game is different. Our game, when things are tough, prices are really low and they're trading based on the assumption that tough times will continue. You've got to be a buyer. You've got to find some way of flipping the instincts to sell and panic and become a buyer at those moments. And we're talking about very sophisticated funds and very famous investors who were talking about moving to cash and how dangerous things were and were selling in their portfolios. And it turned out that was roughly at the lows. When London and New York locked down, that was very close to the lows. So anybody who sold on those headlines lost a lot of money. I think the way out of that trap is to be consistent and to really believe in the long term and then not to play around with your exposures when things really start moving. That's when you can really get into trouble. And we learned that the hard way through other sell-offs, through other things that have happened over the last 13, 14 years. It's the long-term investors and particularly the people who invested in technology broadly did the best, especially coming out of those situations. This isn't a one-off. It's exactly what happened in 2015, 2016. It's exactly what happened in 2011 with the Euro crisis. Even the GFC, technology stocks and high-quality growth stocks dropped as much, if not more, than market indices. We're back at new highs much faster than the broader indexes. So I think we've learned a lot through those grueling episodes. There's probably one thing I'll also mention. It's an ancient concept, and that's like you meet your fate where you try to avoid it. The idea is that you're trying to avoid some particular prophecy or something, and you take a different path, and that's where whatever was forecast to happen happens. I feel like markets are very similar. The people who sat in risk management meetings in March and said, okay, we don't know what's going to happen, which is true. This could get a lot worse. It certainly could have. And then on the basis of that, decided, okay, it's not like people are panicking around and tearing their hair out. It's very sensible, measured conversations. Let's take some risk off the table. Let's reduce our net exposure. That was what destroyed the value. So it was attempting to avoid that fate that actually led to it. That's what led to underperformance for many people this year. I think that's really interesting to think about. It's just one of the things that makes investing so hard and so interesting and also so much fun is that it's really difficult and you have to kind of reverse. Often everybody's zigging and you want to zig, you have to zag. I think it's just a really interesting ancient concept that's extremely relevant to the world we live in today.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been wonderful having you with us.
Thanks, Terry. I really enjoyed it and appreciate you having me on.